May it please the court, Justice Hardesty, Justice Paragary, Justice Stieglitz. I'm Deborah Westbrook from the Clark County Public Defender's Office on behalf of the appellant Braulio Enciso Benitez. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. In Ferretta versus California, the U.S. Supreme Court held that a defendant cannot be forced to accept legal representation against his will. But that's exactly what the Justice Court and the District Court did to Braulio in this case. The courts forced Braulio to accept assistance from the Public Defender's Office, which delayed both his preliminary hearing and his trial against his express wishes. Without legal basis, the courts deprived Braulio of his Sixth Amendment right to personally defend himself. These were structural errors, and they require automatic reversal. I want to begin by speaking about the Ferretta error that occurred before the prelim. Before his preliminary hearing, Braulio repeatedly and consistently sought permission to represent himself. On July 27th, he sent the Justice Court a motion requesting pro se legal representation. Since he was represented by private counsel at that time, it was filed in correspondence. But the motion was raising concerns about the length of time that he had been spending in custody without any, you know, preliminary proceedings. He'd been in custody for 6 months at that point. But instead of letting him represent himself, the court ended up appointing the public defender's office a few weeks later. And the public defender, upon being appointed, needed an additional extension to get familiar with the case. And so the preliminary hearing was put off from August until October. On August 20th, 2015, Braulio sent the Justice Court's second motion, again requesting pro se legal representation. He raised his concerns with the delays that had been happening. He wanted to represent himself, and he actually cited Ferretta in his motion and even the Nevada Constitution. Of course, again, that motion was treated as correspondence. A month and a half later, he finally got the opportunity to personally address the Justice Court at the Ferretta canvas. That was on October 1st, 2015. At that hearing, Braulio said unequivocally that he wanted to represent himself. He said it twice. When Judge Bennett explained that Braulio had a right to an attorney, he said he understood. When Judge Bennett explained the benefits of having a lawyer and the drawbacks of self-representation, including, discussions of what happens at trial, selection of jurors, arguments, and evidentiary issues that a public defender would have been a better, vehicle to present those things, he said he understood that he was foregoing those rights. Unfortunately, when Judge Bennett asked Braulio why he wanted to represent himself, she did not like the answer that he gave. He was, again, complaining about delays, complaining about being in custody. And again, his main concern was that the public defender, who was appointed in August, had continued the prelim. But at that point, we're a week out from the prelim, so I don't know if the court kind of understood that this was an ongoing, long-term concern of his. He didn't use proper legal jargon, excuse me. He referred to the prelim as the short trial, and he confused the word arraigned with arrested at another point. But that's, to be expected with somebody who's, just a lay person. Judge Bennett ultimately made three statements explaining why she was denying Braulio the right to represent himself. First, she said, "We don't really need to get much farther than this to know that you're not going to be in a position to. You can't represent yourself. You don't even know how to tell me what stage of the proceeding you're in." Her second statement, "Right now you are in a situation where you really do need somebody with a trained legal background to help you because you don't even seem to understand the preliminary process. I can't imagine what it would be like to have you trying to facilitate your defense at the time of a preliminary hearing, let alone a trial." Then at the end of the hearing, Judge Bennett made a final statement, "I don't believe that Mr. Benitez is in a position to represent himself, so that motion is going to be denied." Judge Bennett's ruling was an abuse of discretion. Under Ferretta, Braulio was entitled to represent himself as long as he was competent to stand trial and as long as he waived the right knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently. Under Ferretta, his technical legal knowledge, his ability to use the proper jargon, totally irrelevant. And in fact, this court has recognized only 5 situations where a court has the discretion to deny a request for self-representation. The defendant's incompetent, that wasn't the case here. 2, the request is untimely, that certainly wasn't the case here. He'd been requesting it for months. The request is equivocal. Well, he made it pretty clear that he was requesting to represent himself. He did not want his first attorney, he didn't want the public defender. The request was, the fourth question is whether the request is made solely for the purpose of delay. And in fact, we have the exact opposite being the case here. He wanted to go yesterday to his prelim. And then you have 5, the defendant abuses the right to self-representation by disrupting the judicial process. Again, no evidence of that. Judge Bennett didn't find any of those situations existed. So without question, she abused her discretion by denying him the right to represent himself. So what standard of review do we apply to a Feretta error in justice court? Both the U.S. Supreme Court in McCaskill versus Wiggins and the Nevada Supreme Court in Gallego and Hyman have said that a Feretta error in district court is per se reversible. And it's our position that structural error is the only appropriate standard of review, no matter when that error occurs, because of the nature of the right. And so when you look at the right to represent yourself, it is a personal right. It's described as a personal right repeatedly in Feretta. It's a right that's, quote, given directly to the accused because he's the one who faces the consequences if the defense fails. It involves free choice, personal autonomy, and essentially, as Justice Blackmun described in his dissent, it's the constitutional right to make a fool of yourself. So when a defendant chooses to represent himself, he is almost always worse off than he would have been if an attorney had been helping him. And that's why in McCaskill, the Supreme Court said that this type of error is not amenable to harmless error review. So we should think about what would happen if the court decided going forward to apply harmless error to Feretta errors at prelim. Essentially, no appellate court would ever find a defendant would have been better off at trial if they'd only been allowed to get up there and make a fool of themselves at prelim. So without a remedy, the right to represent yourself at prelim becomes an illusory right. And that's why the Kansas Supreme Court has already ruled that structural error applies to Feretta errors at prelim. And we cited that case in our brief at State versus Jones. But there's an additional problem. When the court makes an improper Feretta ruling before the preliminary hearing, it actually undermines that defendant's rights in the district court, his Feretta rights. Such an error, when it occurs, the defendant is then forced to continue immediately into district court with representation of counsel that he doesn't want. So that's happening immediately when they're in the district court. It's an ongoing violation. And when you have a ruling on the merits, as we had in this case where, you know, Judge Bennett is basically telling him, you're not in a position to represent yourself. You are not qualified. That has a chilling effect on the likelihood that a defendant is going to feel like, okay, I guess I'm not qualified. They may not ask or verbalize it later. So the error continues. We can't really speculate, just as with other errors that occur in the district court, we can't speculate as to how that would impact the trial and whether he was ultimately able to assert his right to represent himself. So it's our position it's a structural error. Now, the state wants this court to apply harmless error analysis based on Holman versus Alabama and Patterson versus State.
Just before you get there, do you believe this court should accept that counsel requested that he represent himself at district court?
That's our position, that counsel, essentially the court interpreted what counsel said as a request, and then the court responded by saying, no, you don't get to represent yourself because I'm not comfortable with my ability to communicate with you. So I do, and when I get to that argument, I'll go into that in more detail. So essentially, there's Coleman and there's Patterson. And I know a couple of the justices here are very familiar with Patterson. Those cases are distinguishable because they involve a different Sixth Amendment right, which is the right to assistance of counsel. And the whole purpose of that right, the right to assistance, it's stated time and again throughout the Coleman decision. It's the right that ensures a defendant gets a fair trial. That's the underpinning of the right to counsel. Every time there you have a critical stage of the trial, you know, whether it be when somebody is interviewing, a police officer is interviewing a defendant, you want to look at whether that error, if the attorney was not present during that critical stage, whether that had an impact on the fairness. And all of those cases are really about the fundamental fairness of trial. And that makes sense when you're dealing with a right that's designed to preserve a fair trial. But Feretta is fundamentally different. It describes the right to counsel in the opinion as a, quote, defense tool and a, quote, supplement to the right to defend personally. And even in part four of the Feretta decision, the Supreme Court explains that the two rights are at cross purposes. You know, one is going to help you get a fair result. The other is most likely going to result in your conviction. But ultimately, it's the right of autonomy that the Supreme Court recognized. And once that right is taken away, it's taken away. That's the harm. It's immediately it's immediately the harm. So that's why it has to be structural error.
Can I ask you a question? Just trying to clear this up for myself. At the district court level, my understanding is he didn't ask to represent himself directly. His lawyer indicated to the judge that, objects to the continuance, he'd like to represent himself.
So essentially,
make any difference?
I don't think it makes a difference, because essentially what happened in the district court is the judge was made aware of his prior request to represent himself in justice court. The fact that the justice court had denied those requests, the fact that he strongly objected to any sort of continuance happening, and his attorney representing to the court. If this continuance is granted, he wants to represent, I believe it's going to be his request that he wants to represent himself. The court was on notice that that was his issue and that was his concern. But instead of asking him any questions about, do you want to represent yourself? The court completely set that issue aside, asked him whether he thought his attorney could be prepared in time. And he made it clear that I want to go. And instead of actually doing the diligence that the court was required to do, I think the Gallego case actually sets forth, the standard for what a court needs to do when there's an ambiguity. You need to actually ask the question, do you want to represent yourself? If it's even at all an issue. But instead of doing that, the court shut him down and said, nope, she made a ruling. You don't get to represent yourself. And at that point, what's he supposed to do? Once he's been told expressly by the judge, you don't get to represent yourself, what is he supposed to do at that point?
What about the argument that his request was equivocal?
I don't think if you look at the case law on when a request is equivocal, usually it talks about, if this happens, I'm not sure I want an attorney. I don't like the attorney I've got. Maybe I could do better representing myself. I mean, it's kind of like, I'm not sure. There's some sort of ambiguity as to what the appellant or the individual wants. And in this case, there is no ambiguity at all. You know from the very beginning that what he wants, and you're allowed to look at the entire record. A lot of these cases will even go back to justice court. What happened? What did he say? And all these points in time. You're allowed to go back and look at what his intention was. And there was nothing equivocal about his intentions in this case.
Ms. Westbrook, if I may, on the Sanborn issue.
Sure.
When did the defendant request, did the defendant specifically request those items be preserved, the body cam, the auto, and then the body camera footage, and then did the state destroy it? Like, what were the circumstances around that?
I'm not entirely sure what the time frame was, but, discovery requests are sent. I think it may have been before the discovery request was sent in this case.
Thank you.
Hey, please support Charles Martinowski for the state. First of all, I would like to say something about the Feretta canvas at prelim. I think the case law is very clear, Patterson, as well as U.S. Supreme Court Coleman, that standard of review for an error which occurs at prelim is harmless error. And in Patterson, I would like to point out that in that particular case, the defendant wanted Mr. Ogata to represent him, but he was forced to have Mr. Tannery. So Mr. Ogata was there. He sat through the preliminary hearing. And even though he wanted a different lawyer, the court found that the standard of review would be harmless error, and that the defense, when they filed a motion on appeal, could not establish that he had not shown that he had shown there was no harmless error, that it was his burden. And defense today has been arguing that they could never show harmless error, that because they could never show harmless error, therefore, he gets a greater right. That argument the court should reject. First of all, there's no case law supporting that. There's nothing that the defense has cited to other than just their wishes that if a defendant cannot show harmless error, therefore they get structural error. And second of all, Hooks indicates that at a preliminary hearing is tremendously different from a district court trial. And Hooks also does state that even if there were a valid Feretta canvas at prelim, there would have to be another one in the district court, thereby contemplating that an individual who wants to represent themselves at prelim, even if it's granted, would have to make another request for a more thorough canvas in the district court level. So there is no carryover from any error that may or may not have happened at the preliminary hearing and the district court. As well, I would also like to point out that the standard of review is looks for abuse of discretion. Judge Bennett-Herron conducted the examination of the defendant. And abuse of discretion means that the court did not give meaningful consideration to the issues. There is an extensive record where Judge Bennett-Herron examined the defendant, asked him questions about where he was, what he was doing, and she was not satisfied that he could make a knowing and intelligent waiver. So for two reasons, the court should reject the claim that if there was a...
She didn't say that.
No.
She said you're not in a position to represent yourself. Correct. I'm not even sure I understand what that means. It would seem like if the judge is going to conduct a Feretta canvas, the jurisprudence surrounding Feretta provides pretty specific indication as to what the judge is supposed to find.
That's correct.
And as counsel outlined during her opening, it's one of five things. Where in the record would we look at the judge's determination in this case, Justice Crutcher's determination in this case, and identify any of those five things? I don't know what is meant. You're not in a position. Does that mean, you know, I'm not communicating with you, or you're left-handed, or I don't know what that means. It's not part of the charismatic words or the elements that we've used as exceptions, or excuse me, findings that avoid Feretta.
That's correct. It's not the best waiver. You know, I'm not hanging my hat on that.
Okay.
I mean, the standard of review is very low. I submit to the court that it's not an abuse of discretion. She asked a number of questions, but I started off by arguing that it should be harmless error.
Why should it be different than a defective Feretta canvas in district court?
Well, first of all, the court would have to overturn established jurisprudence. We have Coleman versus Alabama, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case, saying that if a defendant didn't have a lawyer at prelim at all, it would still be harmless error. And then we have Nevada case law, like I cited Patterson, which indicates that if there's a violation of a Sixth Amendment right, it's a harmless error review. And then we have the rationale for that distinction, which would be Hooks, saying there's a big difference between a preliminary hearing and a trial. And second of all, even if there was a valid Feretta canvas at prelim, it would rarely be sufficient to hold over at district court and be sufficient there. There would always have to be at least two. The purpose of a preliminary hearing is slight to marginal evidence. Any prejudice the defendant might suffer is minimal. And so based on established case law and public policy and case law and the difference procedurally between a prelim and a district court hearing, the court should reject the claim that we have structural error at a preliminary hearing.
Well, it does seem that if it's under a harmless error standard, that undercuts or vitiates the Feretta right of self-representation, I should say, at the justice level. Because it's hard to imagine a case where a defendant could establish error wasn't harmless.
Well, a person on suffering depends on the defendant, obviously. There are going to be, we can't say that in every case. There might be some defendants who are scientific expert. DUI cases are complicated, but there could be a defendant in theory who's a scientific expert on at the field. And again, case law is pretty clear. Patterson versus State is right on point. It says the defense has a burden to show harmless.
Well, I think counsel's got a point, though. I think in Patterson we were talking about the Sixth Amendment right to counsel's assistance. I think we were talking about an individual's right to self-representation.
It was about the defendant's right to choose his own attorney. So in
but
this
it was
case,
a right
how
to assistance, not the right to self-representation.
That's correct.
You know, and the facts in this case are kind of interesting. Maybe they lend themselves to self-representation. Had the personal encounters here with these folks about whether they saw him or whether they could identify him. And he also was aware that there were some issues about the absence of body camera data and the car itself. I don't know if he knew that at the time of the prelim. There were some pretty good things for a defendant to talk about in this case, with or without counsel, don't you think?
No, I don't, because you would have Ray Kelly doing on, there was a retrograde extrapolation, the blood being outside of 2 hours. We have a number of issues regarding consent, Fourth Amendment issues that have to be litigated. There's no way this defendant could have cross-examined a PhD on a retrograde extrapolation to demonstrate what the blood alcohol was.
Well, that might be true, but he's got a right to do it if he wants to, and he waives, knowing that he's waiving that opportunity by having an attorney do it. My point is, you're not suggesting, are you, that when a defendant requests self-representation, that the judge is going to say, look, you've got the right to have this lawyer, and this lawyer is probably going to do a more effective job of cross-examination than you'll do. And the defendant says, I get that, but I want to do it myself.
No, he has that right. Absolutely.
And but my reading of the record in the Justice Court is that's what he did. He basically said, yeah, I get all that. I want to do it myself. Didn't he say that?
He did say that. That's so correct.
What's the basis for us concluding that the judge, Bennett, didn't abuse her discretion? I mean,
she may have.
In the colloquy that goes back and forth, it looks to me like you've got a competent defendant saying, I get all that. You've asked me all this stuff. You've told me all this stuff. I don't care. I want to do it myself.
That's correct.
Can a defendant do that under?
You can. And the canvas, I have not denied that it was the best canvas. There are students in my, saying that he shouldn't get a new trial because of this error. One is that the canvas.
Let's turn to the district court. I'm sorry for interrupting. I didn't let you finish your comment. Go ahead and finish your comment.
Oh, just that we would have to overturn established precedent, which clearly states that the error for Sixth Amendment violation at a prelim is.
Okay, so we're on the same page. Let's turn to the next question then, and that's the district court.
Yes.
Counsel argues, Ms. Westbrook argues, that there's some level of ambiguity about his request in the district court for self-representation. I think that's present in the record, don't you?
Yes.
So what the trial judge seems to have done with that, though, is to shut the whole thing down and grant the continuance. She doesn't ask him any forensic questions. She doesn't ask him any self-representation questions. What do we do with that ambiguity? Isn't it true that the judge is supposed to pursue that ambiguity and determine whether or not it should be further evaluated?
Well, the standard is that the request would have to be unequivocal. And the record merely has his lawyer saying, and this is a quote, I think it's going to be his request to represent himself in that case. And then as you read the rest of the transcript, there's a lot of discussion about a continuance. And so the defendant himself wanted to continue the case anyway. He was saying a lot of different things. He said he wanted to go to trial and he wanted to retest the blood. So right there, there's some ambiguity. But once he has an attorney, his attorney can file a motion. His attorney can make the request unambiguous, but he didn't. All he said was, I think it's going to be his request to represent himself in this case. The court didn't inquire much further, but did state that basically, I'm having trouble communicating with you. So she couldn't even get to any questions because she couldn't talk to
him. What was the problem with communication?
She had asked him some questions, and that's up to her. She said she couldn't speak to him and communicate.
She didn't ask him, do you want to represent yourself?
No, she didn't.
Let's turn to the Sanborn instruction. Would you comment about that, please?
Well, again, the court had asked about the body camera was deleted by the officer McGill. It was a new system. Officer McGill had deleted the body camera by accident. There was a process where this didn't come out until the trial, mm-hmm. or right before the trial. So the body camera was a new system.
That wouldn't have been known at the prelim.
No. And Metro's policy as to the vehicle, they don't have enough room. It's not my request, but they don't have enough room in the yard to store all the cars. So after a certain period of time, they get rid of them.
Get rid of all of them?
Unless we specifically say save this car, that one Detective Solomon sold at auction.
Had the defense made a request?
Not at that time. It wasn't. He sold it before.
Okay, so before any request, it was already had already been disposed of.
Yes. And so, again, the case law is very clear that they would have to establish prejudice. One of the problems with Sparks and Sanborn is there was no other corroborating evidence. But in this particular case, there were photographs of the vehicle, which showed a cleaning. There was dust all over the car, and there was a cracked windshield, a huge dent in the front hood, and there was a tire mark on the front bumper. There was also a witness who had, so there's lots of corroborating evidence. There was a witness who saw him, the defendant, passed out at the wheel a few short distance from the accident. She saw him driving on the road in that direction, weaving all over the road. He crashed into a sign. Then she turned off. That was Phyllis Johnson. She then drove back because she was dropping off her daughter at her mother's house, and that's when she observed the accident. She called in on 911 while observing the defendant weaving all over the road. That's how they got his license plate number.
But I thought her observation was of a different color car.
The car, the photograph...
Didn't she testify that the car was a white car and the one that was involved by the initial sighting and the one that was found on his premises was a green car?
No, I believe that she said it was brown, and people were calling 911 as well, and some people on 911 calls said there was a white car and said there was a greenish car. No one, we could never find out who those people were because they didn't leave their names.
But what color car did the lady who testified she saw the accident, what she did?
She
described?
She didn't see the accident, right?
No, she didn't see the accident. She saw the defendant at a stop.
I thought you said she'd seen it, and I didn't understand that from the
record. Yeah, she didn't see the accident. She saw the defendant passed out at a stoplight right before the accident in terms of distance and minutes before the accident. And she was following him down the road, and she called 911 saying, here's the license plate number. He's weaving all over the road. She said he had a Bluetooth earpiece, and then when Officer McGill arrived at his house, he had a Bluetooth in his ear. It was booked into evidence. So the position regarding Sanborn and Sparks is that, first of all, the defense got a partial Sanborn instruction. They cannot show prejudice because there was so much other corroborating evidence, and even if there were, it would be harmless error review, which, again, the corroborating evidence was overwhelming. Again, there was a photograph. And in all candor, the whole case depended on this photograph. It showed a cleaning. There was dust all over the car, a cracked, the front hood was bashed in, the windshield was cracked, and there was a tire from a bicycle, a tire imprint from a knobby tire from a mountain bike on the front bumper of the vehicle. And there was no dust on the area where it looked as if a large object, possibly a human being, had hit the windshield. So in terms of the Sanborn instruction, again, there was a lot of corroborating evidence. The defendant, the defendant got a partial Sanborn, and even if there were an error, it would be harmless.
In a case like this, where obviously eyewitness identification is the defense, why shouldn't the district give a more particularized requested instruction on eyewitness?
Because again, the case law is very clear. I believe it's Nevius is right on point. I mean, we would be asking the district court to change established case law and precedent, which specifically holds.
Well, it wouldn't be error for the court to give that instruction. Nevius doesn't say a court cannot give
correct
that eyewitness instruction, right?
Yes, because it's duplicative. I mean, if we were to give a specific jury instruction as to every single request by the defense, then the jury instructions will become unwieldy. They're all covered by other instructions, and again, the district court is following established precedent.
Okay, any other questions? No, all right, thank you very much, counsel.
Try to wrap this up quickly. So the state says that this court would have to overturn established precedent in Coleman and in Patterson in order to find that the error at prelim was structural. In fact, the court doesn't have to overturn any established precedent because the rights are different. So I think the court can easily distinguish those two types of cases and reach the result that we're asking the court to reach. The state raised the case Hooks, which said that a Faretta canvas at prelim is not necessarily going to be sufficient for trial. But in fact, that doesn't mean that the converse is true, that an erroneous Faretta canvas before prelim can't be a structural error. The logic does not go both ways in that issue. The state and the court has pointed out, yes, there was an ambiguity. And actually, the Gallego case speaks to what the court is required to do in the event of an ambiguity when a request, the court is on notice that somebody might want to represent themselves. And in Gallego, this court said, Although an unequivocal request for self-representation can be conditional, it must speak to self-representation and not simply to a dissatisfaction with current counsel. And a court can insist the defendant explicitly choose to proceed pro se once informed that a substitution of counsel will not be permitted. Gallego's request went beyond dissatisfaction with counsel and expressly sought self-representation, but he was never presented the explicit choice to proceed in pro per. And the court found that, this court found that it was an abuse of discretion to even conclude that his request was equivocal based on the record where the court didn't even ask the question. So if that was an error for the district court to do it, I don't think this court can find his request equivocal on these facts where the question wasn't asked. On the eyewitness ID issue, the state raises the Nevius case, which that was a 1985 case that actually predated later cases, McCraney and Margetts, which say that the defense has the right to have the jury instructed on his theory of the case as disclosed by the evidence, no matter how weak or incredible that evidence may be. So I would say in light of subsequent case law, the court needs to take into consideration that this went to the heart of his defense. His defense was self-defense, or I'm sorry, his defense was lack of ID, and the only thing that he did in his case in chief was present an eyewitness ID expert. So this was his case, and he wasn't allowed to present evidence or present a jury instruction that went to the theory of his case. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Whisper, Ms. Jordan. Martineski, I apologize for the mispronunciation. You both did an outstanding job this morning in argument. We thank you for your arguments today, and the case will stand submitted.